It's The Fake Show featuring Kendall Tenney and Jim Tofte, with our apologies to everyone.
Time now for part two of our interview with former Raiders bass player Phil Fang Volk, who talks about everything from Brian Wilson jamming with Hendrix and the brilliance of producer Terry Melcher. Was Terry Melcher kind of steering you guys in a Stones, Animals type of direction? I heard a lot
of Stones.
And with you and Mark Lindsay, your voices, the way they mixed.
Well, you know what? Actually, when you say that, and I'm not bragging here.
No.
But some people have referred to me as the other voice of the Raiders.
Yes.
And the reason being is I got more solos on the album than any other Raider except for Mark. Mm. Terry Melcher was a huge Rolling Stone fan, and he loved Van Morrison, and he loved Eric Burdon's voice. Huh. So when I sang Baby Please Don't Go, which is Van Morrison, and I'm Crying, which is Eric Burdon, and he heard the sound of my voice, was had that crossover between Eric Burdon and Van Morrison and Mick Jagger, he wanted to use me more. He wanted me to be on some of the singles. That raised a loud protest from Mark.
Yeah, I suppose.
And then Mark got Paul on his side. Terry fought to get me on In My Community as a single and put Great Airplane Strike on the B-side. But instead, it was Great Airplane Strike was A and In My Community was the B-side.
So you get into the Brotherhood era. Was that something where I just have a feeling that other musicians respected you guys for making that move? That it was kind of scary, maybe, to kind of go off on your own like that. But
extremely risky. You can't believe how the music community of musicians rallied around Brotherhood. We had some of the most notable people hanging out at our studios. We had half a Jefferson Airplane, half a Creedence Clearwater. We had Dave Crosby from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. We had Stephen Stills with hanging out. We had Lee Michaels hanging out with us. We had Jimi Hendrix jamming with us at our studio. We were considered very hip, very cool, and respected for what we did, that we were moving on, we were moving up to a different kind of music that was more relevant to what was happening in the music scene.
Like Stephen Stills did and David Crosby when they left Buffalo Springfield or the Byrds or however it worked. Yeah, they totally related to it.
Related to it. They said, hey, we got to keep progressing as songwriters and artists. We can't get stuck in something that's fading away or not relevant. And that's just the way the mindset was in those days, you know? We were on track a lot of the time with the Raiders. I'm not putting down the Raiders' music, and I'm not trying to put down anybody in the band, including the lead singer, because he was a great performer, a great front man, but he had a different vision for the band, and Paul went along with it. But Stepping Stone was kind of a milestone for us. The Sex Pistols recorded Stepping Stone from our version, and they put out, you know, that Mojo magazine from England.
Sure.
You know, it was a great punk band. I didn't relate to them.
Yeah.
But why did they like it so much? Because they thought it was the best garage band rock. It was the best, punkiest song they'd ever heard. And when they put out an album along with a magazine, you know how they stick a CD to the front cover of a magazine?
Yeah.
And our version of Stepping Stone, it says, Stepping Stone by Paul Revere and the Raiders. They loved our version. That's one kind of compliment, you know.
Your song, Louie Go Home, also.
David Bowie.
And as I was looking on some of the other alternate versions of that on YouTube, there were a lot of punk bands that covered that song. Not just Bowie, and I think The Who actually covered it, too.
The Who did one version of it, I think, and Pat Benatar did Just Like Me. I'm amazed at some of the covers that I didn't know about.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they were just on an album, they weren't released as singles, but the fact that so many people respected our music. Now, take a guy like Tom Petty. He's considered extremely cool.
Yeah.
He was with the Traveling Wilburys, and he's got his own band, and his music is well-loved. When Paul Revere died, the day he died, Tom Petty was doing a concert, and in the middle of the concert, he stopped and paid a stunning tribute to Paul, and then played I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. And in his introduction of the song, he says, this wasn't a monkey song, this was a Raider tune. The best version of the song was Paul Revere and the Raiders, and we lost our dear friend Paul Revere.
So Brotherhood, you do, what, three albums with Brotherhood. You had was it a hard time trying to get airplay for that?
It was beyond a hard time. It was such a struggle because, Jim, if you remember, when we left the band, lawsuits happened, you know. Columbia Records sued me and Drake and Smitty for breach of contract. Paul's lawyers talked him into suing us. So we lost most of the money from that last tour. It was a terrible settlement. Our lawyer just wasn't as powerful as Marty Melcher's lawyers. You know, Marty Melcher was Terry's, his corporation formed a corporation for Paul, and we all, you know, incorporated, his team of lawyers and accountants and everything were on Paul's side, and we had this little hometown lawyer that he couldn't rise to the occasion.
No.
We couldn't join another record label. We couldn't sign anything for a year. year and maybe 4 months. Think about going 16 months without being in the public eye, without being...
Well, I'm sitting there right now. Huh? As we record a show in my kitchen. Yeah. I'm there, baby.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you can relate to what I'm saying.
It's a good situation.
Yeah. And you know, good things can come out of bad things. It's a growth period. It was a tremendous growth period. We put out three, I think, really decent albums.
I've heard a few songs online.
I'm sorry I didn't bring the CD for you. The first album was called Brotherhood. And then the second album was called Brotherhood, Brotherhood. And then the third album was called Brotherhood, Brotherhood, Brotherhood. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The third album was called Joyride, Friend Sound. And it was kind of a far out psychedelic album. It's way out there. It's way out in space. And it's sounds and sound effects and jam sessions. And
sounds very Brian Wilson-ish,
yeah, it was
actually.
No, way beyond that. It makes it makes Brian Wilson look like he's in kindergarten.
Well,
no offense.
That's not too far from the truth, actually. Yeah.
No, we love the Beach Boys, and Brian's
I do too.
Brian is a genius. He's earned his stripes, and you know, he's suffered a lot through the process. Brotherhood suffered because we struggled and struggled to get Brotherhood off the ground. We couldn't get the label behind us, and we couldn't get any of the magazines to cover the Brotherhood, because I think Paul and his lawyers talked to all the editors that if you feature these guys, we won't give you exclusives anymore. It just damaged our visibility. When we finally got the lawsuit settled, we signed with RCA Victor, and we went right to work, but the first album we worked on for 6 or 7 months. And the A&R guy kept coming down. He says, guys, you got something for me? You got a single? You got an album? And what's going on here? But the good news is when you listen to the songs, there's production value. There's lyric content. There's relevance. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I'm really proud of what we came up with. And I sent an album to Paul Schaefer on the David Letterman show. And he just called me a few days ago and said, Phil, I just started listening to this Brotherhood album. He says, man, this stuff is amazing. Nice. He says, I can't believe what vision you guys had. You were so right on to that time period. I'm so sorry you guys weren't more successful because this music is awesome. Mm. He just went on and on. And it was nominated in the Grammys. In the first round of the Grammys, we were nominated for Best Liner Notes and Best Historical Album. We can actually say now that it's a Grammy-nominated album. It's kind of strange that the internet comes along and record collectors and the internet...
Resurrects it, right?
It resurrects it. And we somehow held on to a following of record collectors and aficionados who love the 60s and love to trace some of the bands that had these kind of things happen to them.
Did you play any dates when those albums came out?
We did. We played a few dates, not too many. We played in Hawaii, and we played in the Northwest, and we played Birmingham, Alabama.
I remember seeing a 1979, I think, reunion special with Dick Clark and you guys. All the Raiders are back together. What was the feeling then? How were you guys with each other at that point?
All the relationships were perfect, were solid. There was no bad energy. Mark Lindsay had a recording studio in his house. Really nice home. We recorded the track for that presentation with all the background vocals, but we didn't have a lead vocal because for that show, Mark was going to sing live. And that happened a lot. We did the Ed Sullivan show like that. It was called a TV mix, where they mixed the track, but they took the lead vocal off so that the lead vocalist could sing and it would appear very live. We did that on the Smothers Brothers show. You can tell that it's live vocal because Mark muffed the lyric on Ups and Downs.
So was Smitty actually playing the drums along with the recording?
Yeah, because you can see the cymbals moving, but you know, we got to be real good at faking it. You know, nowadays it has such a stigma, you know, lip syncing.
I remember seeing guys who were really bad at it, and not that it was, you know, The Who were a great band, but Keith Moon, and I don't know if he did it on purpose, but he really made it look really bad, you know.
And a lot of the times it was just the fact that they didn't have the staff or the equipment to do live mixing. Yeah. And in those early days of rock and roll, TV mixing was god awful.
Now, you listen to the Ed Sullivan show, as great as that show was and how many great bands they had on that show, but the sound was really echoey. It was not as great as it is now.
Sometimes you only hear the drum. When the Rascals tried to play live on the Ed Sullivan show, all you heard was drums and organ. You didn't hear anything else.
Yeah.
It was a real bad mix. The background vocals weren't there. So on the Ed Sullivan show, we chose to do a TV mix with the track and have Mark sing live. So we could do all the fun stuff and the choreography, but on the Johnny Carson show, we sang and played completely live. Everything, one of the very, very few clips where we were totally live. Get our amps and we start playing, doing a step on top of our amp heads. You know, those Beatle amps?
Yeah, sure.
We're like about 5.5 feet high. We get up on there. We're up high. We're up in the rafters,
yeah.
You know, those amp heads on top of those chrome bars on the Vox Super Beatles, they weren't attached to anything. They were just sitting there. We put our guitars behind our necks and they're playing behind our backs. And the amp head slips forward. And it's just about to take me down. And somehow I counterbalanced myself. And so I didn't fall. But you can see that on the clip. That's how dangerous it was. Drake broke his ankle on that show you just mentioned, the reunion in 1978. We did the same choreography, got on the amps. When Drake jumped off the amp, he broke his ankle. And you can see that on the show.
Was there a thought that maybe we get back together and do a kind of a nostalgia tour?
I think so. I think there was some dialogue. It never materialized because somehow along the way, Mark and Paul got involved in a lawsuit against each other. And that really brought a lot of bad blood into the mix. And Mark and Paul never made their peace before Paul died.
Now, I would be remiss, and she's been very patient here, your wife, Tina Mason, who's been with you since the Where the Action days. Tina, and I don't know if you want to walk around to the
here,
mic, Tina
come over here.
I'm just wondering, who saw who first on the set of Where the Action Is?
Did you see me or did I see you? How did that work?
I saw you because I was working for a whole year when you guys were performing, yeah. And I got to watch you a lot.
And so she had her eyes on me, right? Where she went to this photographer and said, can you take a picture of me and Fang together?
Yeah.
And that's that picture I showed you in the book.
Well, when the show, Paul Revere really invited me to go on the tour with you guys, and I sang before you, and then you guys came in and sang. We were all over the territory. It was really exciting. And then when that was over, you and I went out and got married.
How long after Where the Action Is did you get married? Because you've been married now for how long?
Well, we got married in 67, and I was still with the Raiders in 67. That last tour ended with the Ed Sullivan Show. And then I came home, and, you know, Tina was showing a little baby bump there because we started to get really friendly with each other on that last tour.
Yeah.
Paul said, no, listen, she's a good girl. No, there was 40 guys on this tour and one girl. He said, don't you guys leave her alone. She was so lonely, and I felt sorry for her. I thought, I better take care of this damsel in distress.
That's really nice. I remember as a 10-year-old kid watching Where the Action Is, and I didn't quite understand why I liked Tina Mason so much as a fifth grader, but I did.
Well, Tina Mason, as her album says, her title of album is Something Wonderful. Tina's a wonderful girl, a wonderful singer, a great partner in life, and we've had some wonderful experiences together, especially in those early days when she was touring with us.
So you saw her before you
Oh, that's
met
what I was going to say.
Did you just kind of go,
I saw me on TV.
She seems nice.
I know they were looking for, I know Dick Clark was looking for a replacement. I didn't know Tina. I didn't know her. I come home from tour and I turn the TV on. I'm living alone. I had a nice little house in Studio City, and Tommy Boyce lived down the street, and Barbara Hershey, the actress, lived next door to
me.
And Vic Morrow, the actor, lived next door to me. And it was one of those, you know, streets where there was a lot of celebrities and artistic people. I turned the TV on, and Dick Clark says, and now I'd like to introduce you to the new action girl. And here comes Tina singing a song, wearing these tight shorts, you know, like what they call now bike shorts, those really skin-tight Bermuda shorts.
Do you have a picture with you?
It's in there somewhere, but
just kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah, he wants this, you dirty old man.
I know.
And so I just instantly was smitten by her look, her legs, her beauty, her eyes.
Oh, you guys seemed.
You know, those bedroom
you
eyes.
You seemed and you seem great with each other.
And then we meet each other for the first time, and I'm like a goofy kid, didn't know what to say, didn't know how to act. I felt like I acted really stupid.
Hi, I'm Fang. Here, look at my guitar.
Hi. Hi, I like you. As time went on, we got closer and closer to each other, and she went on tour with us, and that kind of sealed the deal.
Whenever a band, a famous band, has somebody in the band who suddenly has a girlfriend, or they get married, whatever it is, boy, did they catch it from all the female fans, right? I mean, was there any...
You weren't supposed to be married. You were supposed to be available for the fans.
I know that the Beatles kind of kept that secret when they had girlfriends or wives or...
It was funny. It was weird because that was the teen magazine syndrome where they didn't emphasize the marriage mates because the fantasy was this guy is available for the fans. He could marry you someday. Yeah. That was the fantasy. That was the dream. And so they kept it very private. Of course, that was also the time when Brotherhood had formed and we'd been kind of blackballed out of the magazines. We had only a few little articles here and there talking about getting signed with RCA Victor and finally coming out with an album. But
one of the things is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And Rolling Stone seems to have a problem with a few bands. Are there petitions online, petitions trying to get the Raiders into the hall?
Constantly. Every year when the new list comes out, people protest. They send letters to Jan Wenner. I don't know what he has against us. I don't know why he thinks we're so uncool, but in our day, we were considered the coolest, hottest, grungiest American rock band that existed. We were the Rolling Stones from America, and the Rolling Stones were from England. We were considered the bad boys of rock. We were considered the ultimate in garage band rock.
Is it that whole, I don't know, Marx Brothers persona that you guys had on TV that he...
Everybody liked it, though. Look at the Beatles. The Beatles come out with movies like Help and stuff, and it's all about gags and sight gags and slapstick. If you've ever listened to a Beatles news conference, they never gave a serious answer.
Right.
We toured extensively with the Beach Boys. The Rolling Stones were very cool. They wouldn't have brought us on our tour if we were considered uncool. But for some reason, Jan Wenner just doesn't get it. And somehow, he's mentally blackballed us out of his
Chicago.
Well, that's a travesty. Here's Stevie Van Zandt, you know, the guitar player for Bruce Springsteen, huge Raider fan. The Raiders are respected. He says it's terrible that the Raiders have been passed over by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. No, in fact, it's criminal. He's a big advocate of the Raiders.
So do you think it'll ever happen?
Well, it's bittersweet. You know, with Paul gone, Paul had a lot of distaste for these kind of things. And he even made the comment. He says, well, if they're going to give me any honor, they better do it quick because I'm not feeling any better here and I'm not getting any younger. It's unfortunate that it couldn't have happened in Paul's lifetime. You know, Smitty's gone, Drake is gone, but there's some Raiders out there that have a connection to the mainstream of the Raider legacy, like Jim Valley, Harpo. He was there during the heyday. Keith Allison was there during the heyday. So he's still playing a lot of music. And Freddie Weller. You know, who was on the Ed Sullivan show with me.
You're behind a little bit.
That was by design.
It was very distasteful to me.
Well, it was distasteful to me. You know, I had just come from my brother's funeral who died in Vietnam, and I agreed with Paul. We'd already given him our notice, but we all agreed, me, Smitty, and Drake, we all agreed to fly back to New York at our own expense and do the show. I do the TV show so Paul could have the original band on the Ed Sullivan show because this is a milestone for us. Well, we all fly back there, and he had already hired Freddie Weller. So Drake got ousted from doing the show with us, which is sad. I always have a sadness in my heart that Drake wasn't able to perform with us because we could have done all the movements and the choreography and put on a real show. But Freddie Weller didn't know any of the steps, and he wasn't much of a dancer anyway. So we just stood there, and Drake was gracious enough to show Freddie all the guitar chords of the songs we're going to show. Him what to play on how to make it look like he was playing on songs he had never recorded. When he told the people, don't focus too much attention on Fang because he's leaving the group, and so is Smitty. So Smitty and I did the show, and then we went on to form Brotherhood. And
nowadays, what's happening?
Oh, yeah, well, it's Fang and the gang. You know, a simple concept. It might be described as Fang, family, and friends because my wife Tina is in the band, and our two daughters, all great singers and dancers. A lot of showmanship, and you can watch clips of us on YouTube. And there's eight of us, kind of a family band now. We did New Year's Eve in Laughlin. Check us out. I'm also on Facebook if you want to hear the latest and the greatest. The Brotherhood's on CD from Real Gone Music. They're the ones that put it out.
I can't tell you guys what a pleasure this has been for me to have Phil Volk, Fang, and his wife Tina Mason, who have been together
47 years.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming by.
It's what we do. It makes me feel alive to play music. So there's a lot of stuff on Facebook. Can we advertise this stuff?
Yes.
You don't mind, do you?
No.
Now we're talking to the people at the Grammy Awards saying, hey, Don't forget about Paul. Just before I came over here, I sent an email to the person who's coordinating that segment. We'll see.
I hope so. And I would also say pick up The Legend of Paul Revere, that big compilation package, because it's got everything from the early days to...
It has the whole legacy, the whole recording legacy. It's a 2-CD set. There's now a 3-CD set that came out by Collector's Choice called Columbia, the Complete Singles Collection. We're the ones that played our instruments at the recording studio. So if anyone comes out with a different story on that, you're lying to the public, because the truth is, Paul Revere and the Raiders, you know, Smitty, Drake, Mark, Paul, and me, we were the players. We could play. We were musicians before anything else. That was our gig.
When's the movie coming out, my friend?
Well, we're working on a documentary, and we got some people interested, and we got... I went up to Paul's cabin in Idaho. He has a beautiful cabin up in the mountains above Boise. I got him to talk on the video camera for several hours, talk about the old days. He's a great storyteller, as they say, a raconteur. He enjoyed being able to speak, so we have that footage.
Right,
and you know what?
That happens.
It would be a great story.
Yeah.
I hope we can pull it off.
Yeah.
Some people, some production people, movie people that are looking at it, so... Hopefully we'll have a good documentary.
Good, there's a lot to look forward to. And once again, thanks so much, Phil and Tina, for coming by today. It's been just a pleasure.
Thanks for having
us.
Bye-bye.
Join Kendall and Jim next time from Studio G inside Jim Tofty's house. And go to thefakeshow.com for more info.